Hello, it's Jen Taub. Welcome back to Booked Up, a podcast that features you, me, and our favorite authors. We release a new episode every Sunday morning. You can follow us wherever you get your podcasts. Joining me today is Allison McCabe, author of the deeply felt, carefully researched book, Why Sinead O'Connor Matters, which was published this May, just 2 months before the musician's passing. Allison interviewed Sinead for NPR in 2021 in connection with her autobiography, Rememberings. As guitarist and songwriter Vernon Reed wrote about this book, acknowledging that Sinead's life story can be a difficult, contradictory mess, McCabe painstakingly relates this magnificent, irreplaceable artist tale to her own heartfelt story, showing us in the process how and why so many of us also connect with Sinead. A little more on Allison McCabe, who is decidedly Gen X. Before turning to writing, reporting, and production full-time, she taught in the English department at Yale. You've definitely heard her work on NPR's flagship shows like Morning Edition and All Things Considered. One example, Willy Wonka-inspired candy alchemist spins sugar into pure imagination. Or more recently, how artists and influencers set the stage for hip-hop's global rise. You've also seen Allison's byline in assorted places, including the New York Times, New York Magazine's Vulture, BBC Culture, Bandcamp, and Wired. Okay, let's dive in. Hey, Allison.
Hi, Jen. How's it going?
I mean, given the state of the world, I mean, do you want an honest answer or the kind of like polite thing I'm supposed to say to someone I've never met before?
I always prefer the honest answer.
Given everything, I'm doing okay today. I woke up with a little bit of a headache because I had some dental work yesterday, but I have a really good dentist, if that counts for anything.
A good dentist is a good thing to have.
Yeah, and like lots of nitrous oxide plus the Novocaine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, she does the full thing because she knows I'm a baby. So,
okay.
But that's in Northampton. That you lived in the Pioneer Valley at one point.
I did. I lived there from, I want to say, 91 to 93. I transferred into Hampshire, and that's where I got my undergraduate degree in philosophy and feminist theory, I would say. You know, if you know anything about Hampshire, they don't have majors,
yes.
So I have to sort of approximate and translate. But that's what
I can translate.
There.
So, and they also do your start date, usually,
yes.
Not your graduation date, because people take different amounts of time in Hampshire to kind of
that's
complete.
True. I was F91, if that means anything to anybody who's listening.
F91, and what was your Div 3? Who is your advisor?
Oh, wow.
See, I do my research.
Yeah, okay. I work with a woman named Meredith Michaels.
Is she there still?
I don't think so. She went to Smith after that. I'm not sure if she's still teaching anymore, but yeah, it was life-changing to be at Hampshire, you know, given where I'd come from in Philadelphia, just completely different, unimaginably different worlds.
Do you want to tell me more about that? What do you mean?
So, you know, I grew up in Philadelphia, and it's oftentimes you'll ask people where you're from, and they'll say they're from Philadelphia, but they're really not from Philadelphia proper. They're usually from the suburbs, but I grew up in sort of a working class section of the city.
Called Devil's Pocket, you said?
No, actually, my mother was from a neighborhood that was called Devil's Pocket. Now, that's no longer called that anymore. Real estate developers have come up with something a little less scary sounding than Devil's Pocket.
Fishtown or something?
No, Fishtown was, you know, this was in South Philadelphia, Devil's Pocket. So it's sort of like it's called like sometimes like the graduate hospital area or, you know, it has different names, but Asylum Square maybe I think is another name. But at the time it was called Devil's Pocket because the idea when she grew up there was that it was so tough that the neighborhood kids would steal a dollar from the Devil's Pocket. You know, that's how it was. I grew up in Northeast Philadelphia. If you remember back to the last presidential election when there was a news conference held outside of Total Landscaping.
Oh, how could I forget it with Rudy Giuliani? Yes.
I didn't grow up too far from Total Landscaping.
From what was it called? Four Seasons Total Landscaping. There's even a documentary about it. Yeah. It's pretty cool. So, so that's kind of near my oldest kid. Lives in Philly now and presently works up at the medical school. That's maybe north, but not north central, maybe not northeast.
Is it Temple?
No, Drexel Medical School's up
there. Oh, Drexel. So that's on the west side. Like Northeast Philadelphia, it's a very strange little place because it's in the city, but it's sort of, you know, to get from where I lived to downtown, is what we call, or Center City as it's called there.
Yeah.
You know, you had to take a bus to the elevated train. You know, it wasn't really far in terms of mileage, but it was sort of far in the way that when you watch Saturday Night Fever and there's the bridge, you know, from Brooklyn to Manhattan, it seems like it's impossible to get from one place to the other.
It's like it's a psychological and cultural barrier or something.
It is a psychological and cultural barrier. So, yeah, that's where I was from. It's very insular. All the houses are kind of post-war. They called them twins. They were sort of duplexes side by side. And then in the back, there was something that we used to call the driveway. It was an alley, but...
Yeah.
We called it the driveway. So, you know, most of the people that I grew up with are still there or really close by. But I left in 91. I went to Hampshire then. Yeah, it was after I graduated. I was working downtown as a data entry operator. If you're old enough to remember what that is, you know, it's not a very great job. You're just sitting there literally entering data from pieces
downtown,
of paper.
You mean downtown Philly? You moved
downtown
back?
Downtown Philly. No, I'm saying after high school, that's what I was doing.
Oh,
high school.
I get it.
No, I was a data entry operator. And one day I decided not to go to work. And instead, I went to the library and I started reading college guides the way some people might read travel guides, just kind of imagining other places I could be.
Yeah.
And I found Hampshire in one of those. And it said, you know, students do their own thing. You don't need to have taken the SAT. There's no grades. Instead, you write papers. You design your own major. And I thought, well, why not? I've got nothing to lose. It was sort of like scratching off a lottery ticket. And lo and behold, I got in and my whole world
changed.
But
I want to rewind, though, because that's incredible that you found the place and it just seemed to fit the description, what you wanted to do or who you thought you were. But like, there's a lot, I mean, you're a few years younger than me. And back then, you know, to do a college application, it wasn't like online, you had to type it up. I mean, you have to pay a check. I don't know if you had to pay for an application fee.
Oh, yeah,
Did you tell your parents and what did they say about this very, you know, hippy dippy school in Western Mass?
Most people that I'd grown up with never got further than New Jersey. So, you know, Massachusetts, it was sort of like, they've been to Red Lobster. You know, sort of like, is that what it is? No, early on, I had tested into a high IQ program in Philadelphia school system. It has kind of an obnoxious name, but it was called the Mentally Gifted Program. And what that meant
I'm only laughing because this is going to make everyone else hate you.
I know, which is why I didn't really want to bring it up. But, you know.
No, I'm just like, that's a real burden. I, on the one hand, you should be proud of that, but it's like, it's a stigma in some circles, I would think.
Oh, well, look, it wasn't exactly Goodwill Hunting. It's not like I was sweeping the floor at Temple or something and they said, hey, come in and do some math problems. No, what happened was, I had been in this program, you know, I tested into it. And what it meant was one day a week, you got to leave your regular school and go to a better school where you actually got taught really interesting things. Uh-huh. You know, and I learned about, you know, I studied social sciences. This is in elementary or junior high. I mean, this is as a young kid, we did poetry. We learned about art. We went to art museums. I mean, that was something my family never did. So it really had opened up a world to me. But that program ended in high school. And so... You know, by the time I got to high school, I really was not engaged at all. I barely went, as I talk about in my book. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I landed at a data entry job. That was one of the jobs I had after I graduated. And then I also took some classes part-time at Temple University, which at that time was much more of a commuter college. Now it's become a lot more academically competitive. But, you know, I was working full-time and taking classes like 2 days a week. Mm-hmm. So I felt like I was going to be stuck there. You know, I had these vague ambitions of becoming a rock star that hadn't materialized at that point. So I read about the school and yes, I was working. So I had the money to apply and yeah, I got it. I mean, as far as my parents were concerned, yeah, it's just kind of unimaginable to them. I would love to tell you that my mother was supportive, but she wasn't. Her whole attitude was about, you know, you're never going to get in. And even if you get in, I'm never going to give you the money to pay for it. It's going to be all these rich kids and, you know, it's not going to work out. And then you'll be right back here where you started. So, you know, good luck.
Did she ever stop centering herself?
No, actually she did not. And so I went and I got in and I met my first girlfriend at the accepted students weekend. And I actually moved her into our little tiny house.
Is it called a pod or something
a
like
mod.
That? Or is it a mod, not mod. Okay, mod, not pod. I'm trying
a
to,
mod,
okay, yeah.
A modular unit. So they were actually intended to be temporary housing when they were first built. So one was called Prescott. That's where I lived. That was the one that was supposed to be the city, you know, and then there was Enfield, which was the suburbs, and I think Greenwich, which was the, you know, the country. So I lived in the city one. But
so
no, before
funny.
That, I went to the Accepted Students Weekend. I met my first girlfriend there. Turns out she lived not too far outside of Philadelphia, and her home life was no better than mine. So without consulting my parents, I just quietly moved her into our house. And
wow.
And my mother was so scandalized, she said nothing. And then come fall, we just drove off into the sunset.
Incredible. Yep. Incredible. I want to, we will get to the book. But I want to, you mentioned, you know, dreams of being yeah. a rock star. So I want to kind of, maybe that will be a good bridge. And I forgot to ask you where you are
I'm
now.
York.
Are you
no,
in
I haven't,
Philadelphia?
Yeah. No,
oh, you're
in Philadelphia since I drove off into the sunset in 91.
New York is like a bigger
yeah,
Philly.
I would say so. I mean, I've been back certainly a lot, but I haven't lived there since I
yeah.
left.
So you started getting into, because before we get to how you got into Sinead mm-hmm. O'Connor's music and life and then ultimately interviewed her when her autobiography came out in 2021, your interest in music started middle school or high school? How did that develop?
I mean, I would actually trace it back probably earlier, you know, to being about roughly 6 years old and watching Happy Days, you know, and seeing the character Leather Tuscadero, who I didn't know at that time.
I can do oh. that. What is that, snap thing?
Yes,
remember? Or is that Pinky? Was that Pinky Tuscadero?
Yeah, there's the cousin, Pinky.
Oh.
But, you know,
she came first,
I
right?
So.
Pinky?
But Leather was the one
yeah.
who would come on and into Al's Diner, you know, and do the rock and roll songs. And I had no idea that it was actually played by, you know, an actual real life person.
Susie yeah. Quattro. Yeah.
That was
yeah.
kind of a revelation that came later. But at the time, you know, I was just sort of, oh my God, what is that? And then seeing Grease, you know, Grease came out. And I remember sort of seeing, you know, everybody's talking about like they had a crush on Danny or they identify with Sandy. You know, I was like all about Rizzo. You know, I got that.
Uh-huh.
So, you know.
The tough girl is always more interesting,
of course,
isn't she?
Of course.
I mean.
Definitely. And yeah. I think also for me, you know, I was, before we had a name for this, you know, I was a genderqueer girl, you know. And so for me, this was also the first time I saw something that looked like an image of who I was, you know, anywhere in popular
mm-hmm.
culture. So I think that really made me think, ah, you know, that's it, you know. And then later you see other representations like Joan Jett or Chrissy Hynde, you know, there's room in rock and roll for female masculinity. So that was really, that was it. And then of course the idea that like I could get out and be somebody, you know, that's like Piss Factory by Patti Smith, which was not a song I knew back then, but kind of reflected that idea of just like, I'm going to get out of here. I'm going to mm-hmm. be somebody. You know, that was my thinking. So that having failed to work, the future badassery having failed to materialize, you know, from age, let's say.
Well, did you have a band or did you pick an instrument?
I did.
Or did you sing?
Yeah, all of that. I had a really bad guitar I got from like the Best catalog. That was a thing. And, you know, and I sang and I would sit there and I would teach myself by, I would have little cassette tapes and I would just listen to them over and over again, trying to work out how to play them on my guitar. So I didn't have any formal training. But, you know, most of the bands that I you know, some were in the basement, literally. I remember one time early on, I had interviewed Luscious Jackson when they were doing their little reunion. And one of the members of Luscious Jackson was asking me about this. And I was like, ah, you know, we were just in the basement. She's like, was that a club in Philly? I'm like, no, it was literally the basement. It was like actually the basement. And most of them were just in my head, you know, because it was kind of hard to be taken seriously, find, you know, people to let you be in a band as a woman. I discovered that pretty early on. There weren't enough girls that I knew to form an actual all-girl band. A few years back, I was in a little show that was on Euronews where it was a French musician and she came to different cities and would have different guides. And so they had me come on as the Philly guide. And I have no idea where they came up with this, but in the voiceover they came up with after the taping, it said, you know, Allison McCabe, who was in all these all-girl bands in high school. And I was like, I wish I were in all these all-girl bands in high school. Like, that would have been amazing. But most of them didn't, you know, it wasn't going to go anywhere. And then when uh-huh. I got to Hampshire, and this is going to sound kind of, you know, wild, but, you know, queer theory was happening and gender studies and feminist theory. And it was like there were zines and there were even trading cards and action figures of like Michel Foucault and Judith Butler. And I saw that and I was like, that I can do. So
it's so funny. I mean, we're just, it's like when I graduated from college in 89. Right. So it's pretty close. It was, you know, and when I was in law school, I took a year off and I went to law school. And my first year of law school, I was like totally alienated from, I mean, it's funny that I'm back teaching now, but I just didn't like the conformity. I mean, I was a little arrogant and I didn't really actually want to learn what the judges had to say about anything. I wanted my opinion to proceed because that's how I'd been raised as a, you know, I was an English major at Yale, so where you taught. So, you know, there was some deconstruction, there was some feminist theory, there was some Stephen Greenblatt, but I come to trust my own analytical abilities and thought that my authority mattered. But in law, it does, but first you actually have to learn the thinking process and what the, you know, actually holdings are in the authoritative interpretations before you take them apart. I wanted to skip that first part. But yeah, around that same time, you know, I was very into Judith Butler and I took a course my first year in legal postmodernism. And it was fantastic, except for the fact that when I went to interview at the corporate law firms, they would point to that and sort of laugh at me. You know, but now, you know, now who's laughing? Those people are still having to be partners at law firms and I'm writing books. So no,
I'm with you on that. But, I'm with you on that.
Yeah. So did you then sort of did like the rock stars of, you know, literary theory and, you know, Michel Foucault and Derrida and Judith Butler and all these people, did they become your rock stars as a substitute for a while? Sure. That was a place to be transgressive in literature.
And in life. I mean, you know, I think even though I'm not in academia, I mean, many of the ideas that I learned, especially from Foucault, you know, I take with me today. You know, I mean, so I think it was really significant for me. And I excelled, you know, so I think that was another thing is it gave me a sense of self-esteem that I didn't have before. You know, this was really, getting to Hampshire was the first time I actually experienced, outside of that mentally gifted program, anything even remotely resembling education.
What do you think it was? I mean, it's not meant to be a quiz, but what do you think it was about Foucault in particular that transformed the way you thought about things?
I think it was really Foucault's ideas about power, you know, that the very system that's designed, you know, sort of to suppress things actually kind of like creates these opportunities for subversion. You know, I mean, one way I would kind of describe this for your listeners, for like a general audience, is if you think about an electrical current, you know, it's not continuous. There'll be interruptions in the flow. There'll be surges. You know, it's in these moments that there's the possibility for change. And I found that idea so compelling.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's so funny. I took out a pad because you just said something that reminded me probably in the early 90s. I read an interview about Buñuel, the filmmaker. And I think they asked him about his religious training or his religious framework. And he said that he'd been raised Catholic, and I'm not entirely sure whether he said he still felt himself to be a Catholic, but he found it a really excellent foundation against which he could rebel and build something. I mean, it's sort of like the way in which music itself has a structure and, you know, the sort of idea of creativity inside of these rules, but also knowing which rules to break or something. I don't know. Maybe that's part of what is connected to something that you just said.
I think it's sort of what creativity demands, you know, whatever that form that takes, whether that's music or law, you know, anything really. I think the idea is that, as you're mentioning, you have this certain structure, you have this certain rules, you have precedents, but then it's like there's room within all of those things for the possibility of change. And it's sort of about learning what rules are and then thinking about how, in a way, rules can be broken. You know, because sometimes you have to break it, right, to rebuild it better.
Right. Or sometimes you just have to burn it all down.
Sometimes you do.
When you left Philly and went to Hampshire, you changed your surname to McCabe.
I'll clarify. No. I didn't do that immediately. So what happened was McCabe is actually my wife's name, her birth name. My name, you know, I kept through Hampshire, through graduate school, and through the beginning of my academic career. But when I was with my now wife, you know, at that time was just my girlfriend, you know.
You mean she was the same
no,
one
no,
you
no.
met?
No, there have been a few.
Okay.
Come
oh,
on,
good.
Come on. You know,
I was going to say.
53 years old. There have been a few.
I don't need to have the spreadsheet, but after we can talk.
No, I actually, I met her in graduate school in 97. Yeah, 97. But
journalism
no,
school?
I didn't, no, I, this is theory school. I went to a program, okay. which was called Human Science as a Program in Language, Culture, and Society, which I like to say was so cutting edge, it was cut. It was one of these interdisciplinary theory programs that, you know, they took a few students a year and, you know, but within a couple of years after I left, it was completely defunct. But I was there, and this was in Washington, D.C., and my partner was in medical school at Georgetown. And, you know, we met, and when it was sort of serious, we actually had, before we had kids, which we have now, we have three kids, we got a dog, and we found, this was before gay marriage was legal, you know, even dropping the dog off at the, you know, we're going on a vacation, we're going to drop the dog at the shelter, not the shelter, the kennel rather, for a day or two, you know, which one of you is the dog mom? It's like ridiculous. So at that point, I just decided, you know, F the dead name. I kept it as my middle name because I was very close with my grandfather and that was his name. But I moved it to the middle name and I took her name, which is McCabe. And for a little while, I was Allison, that name, McCabe, professionally. But then ultimately, it morphed into just McCabe. And, you know, we had a civil union and then we had like a Massachusetts marriage and then we had like a Connecticut. We've done this so many times. So that's a whole other story. But you know, it became important to me in starting our family to think about, I think, really leaving behind in some ways where I came from. You know, the last time that I had anything to do with my parents was really at that point. You know, I called my mother and said, this is really serious and I want to let you know. And, you know, we're planning to get married. And she was just like, well, you know, that girl is going to dump you and you're going to be right back. The same thing she said about Hampshire, basically. So don't even, you know, invite me to this thing. How come her parents are okay with it? And I was just like, you know, it's a celebration. And if you can't come, don't. If you can't celebrate, don't do it. So, you know, that was pretty much that. And that was fine because if you read my book, you'll understand. I think if you haven't, I just want to say related to that because I think it's important to understanding Sinead, which is after all why we're here talking about Sinead O'Connor.
Oh, we'll get to her.
You know,
I promise.
I really feel that there's so much pressure, no matter how dysfunctional your family is, on people who are abuse survivors to just keep going with their family. Like, oh, I'm sure she's so proud of your accomplishments. Or isn't it sad that she won't meet her grandchildren? These children are not biologically related to her. Like, my duty and obligation is to protect these children from anybody I consider to be abusive. So I just think, you know, that's kind of a taboo still that people don't want to talk about, especially when there's a, quote, bad mother. You know, bad dads, I think we've heard enough about bad dads that people get it. But I think bad moms is like a whole other level of people just do not want to talk about bad moms because it goes so against our most like deeply ingrained notions of what a mother is supposed to be that people are just like, it could really have been that bad. Maybe it's not. You know, let's just say this. If you have kids and they grew up and want nothing to do with you, you fucked up.
Yes, totally true. Totally true. And even if, let me just say this, even if you don't think you did, give them the space.
Mm-hmm.
It's their life.
Yeah.
You know, maybe examine what that is about.
Yeah. So it's not trivial, but I think that, you know, it didn't happen at Hampshire, you know, because I hadn't met McCabe yet. I would have had to come up with something. I would have had to come up with something completely different. But it is funny. The first time when I spoke with Sinead, that was one of her first questions, which was, you know, where my people were from.
Oh, because of the last name.
I don't know where my people were from, to be honest. My mother told me so many contradictory stories about where my people were from. I'm a little bit scared to take a 23andMe. It might be like 23 crooks in me, you know?
You know, if I'm glad that I did for a number of reasons, but it doesn't really reveal that much for me. But,
okay.
You know, we are who I thought we were, which wasn't entirely that interesting.
It's always on TV. It's always like, and this person who was your great whoever was the founder of this amazing thing or changed the world in this or that way. They're never like, she was kind of a bore and he gambled, you know?
What was pretty cool, though, that I found out one of my guests a few months ago, do you know the comedian Judy Gold?
A little bit.
It turns out for some reason I was looking and we're like distantly cousins.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is pretty, pretty awesome.
That is awesome.
I can't believe it. Okay. So let's get into the book.
Okay.
I am so glad that I read your book, Why Sinead O'Connor Matters.
Thank you.
For those who haven't read it yet, the reason why I'm asking Allison so much about herself is because she has a way of weaving herself into this. It's the kind of, I can kind of call it a biography or analysis that is real in that we all relate to art or artists, not just like they're not just out there. It's about our relationship to them. And I think anyone who does art thinks about their work in relationship to whoever receives it. So I wanted to know, I feel like sometimes I can't even talk about someone's work either unless I know more about them. But I guess where I want to start with this book, which came out this summer, is the hardest part, which is your book came out and now Sinead's gone.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering how you found out and how you're doing with that. It's only been around 10 days.
Not even. I think it was last Wednesday. We're talking on Thursday, August 3rd. This was on the 26th of July. I mean, where I was when I heard was I was driving one of my kids home from a music lesson and I wasn't looking at my phone. I wasn't listening to the radio. I was talking to my kid and I got a text actually from my editor at NPR. And she said, you know, have you heard? It's hard for me to describe how I felt in that moment, except to just say that, you know, devastated, gutted, and immediately, I said, I'm walking in my house. I was like putting on a Zoom shirt, like walking into the house, you know, like basically I'm here to cover. And they said they had it already covered. So before I could really react to that, my phone just exploded. I mean, I'm not on social media for, you know, reasons we can talk about. So half the time, I mean, I don't even know where some of these people got my cell phone number, honestly. But it was just call.
People had your phone?
Yeah. It
was, number?
Yeah. People are calling, texting, emailing, and not just in the U.S., you know, it was Ireland, it was England, it was Canada. And I didn't sleep for like the first 30 hours at all because, you know, I was just getting a lot of requests to speak on this. And, you know, I wrote this book, you know, as you mentioned, it came out in pre-orders. It was May 9th. You know, they got delivered then. It was May 23rd for the public release. And, you know, I just come off a tour, an 8-city tour. It was kind of like, okay, you've done that tour now, you know, it seems to be like there's a couple of requests coming in, but the big burst of, you know, your book has come out is sort of passing.
Right.
And, you know, so it was out there. People knew that I'd had this book and I think that's how they found me. I don't know how they actually found my phone number, but that's how they found me to talk about it. I was on CBS Nightly News that night and I did 3 print pieces overnight for like LA Times, BBC, and Vulture. But, you know, it was just calling into radio shows and, you know, again, in Ireland and England and Canada. It's not a brag. This is just to say I didn't have a chance to even process what happened because in that moment, you know, my number one goal was there had been so much misinformation and so much misreporting about Sinead over all those years. I just wanted to make sure that to the extent that I was able to say yes, that I took every opportunity that was given to me in order to really talk about her music and her life and her legacy. And so I just like kept going. And because Europe's on different time zone, you know, it just kind of went it, like the night rolled into
around
the next
the clock,
day.
Those 30 hours.
Yeah, those 30 hours. And then, you know, it's been pretty steady since then. And, you know, I feel like I'm not very, it's a good thing we're not on video right now. I feel like a bit of a husk of a person, but I think that it's really important to do that work because that's one way that I can really honor who she was and what she meant and what her legacy should be moving forward, you know, and it has so much more to do with who she was as a person as an artist than it was that one big hit song that she had in 1990 or that one moment on TV in 92.
Let's talk about those. And since you mentioned them, I'm imagining that most of the people who listen are Gen X or older, but there may be people, surprisingly, who don't know what that big hit was or what that moment was. on MTV. Before we do that, though, I'm so glad, I just want to say, I'm so glad that you went out there and did try to address the misinformation.
Thank you.
It's critical. And it's also a way, sometimes when you're in a state of shock, I think for many of us, working is a thing that we can do
to
stay calm, because it's what using our brain, putting that in gear, is a way to control the emotional side, I think.
Yes.
At least I'm speaking for myself.
Oh, no. Yeah, for sure. For sure. For sure.
Okay. So what are those? What were those moments?
Well, I think, you know, it's probably important to say here that I was not a lifelong Sinead O'Connor fan. That's not how I came to the book. You know, that I had had this, you know, experience growing up. And by the time, you know, 1987 rolls around, I'm 17 years old. That's when her first album comes out, The Lion and the Cobra. And, I didn't have really access to that. I wasn't listening to the radio at that point. It wasn't on the radio that much, except for on college and alternative radio. But I was really into sort of punk music. I was really like, that was music I was interested in was on no station and not on MTV at that point. So I kind of vaguely knew she was. And then I was, you know, in college when 1990 rolls around, that's when she has the album, I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got. And on that album, she has this big hit, which is Nothing Compares to You. And I think she kind of failed to land for me a little bit because, you know, by this point, I'm at Hampshire, you know, F91, so it's still kind of like right after she broke. And a lot of girls at that time had shaved hair. A lot of girls wore combat boots. Like, the song didn't sound like a punk song to me. I mean, her voice was beautiful, but I was just kind of like, okay, that's a really good pop song. That's cool. You know, I wasn't invested so much in knowing about her because of also things that I had seen, let's say, in magazines. Like, the coverage really didn't go into who she was. You know, it was more just like, as I talk about in the book, rediscovering it later, just like, oh, she's so hot. I wish I could F her, you know? That's really what a lot of the writing was about at that time, about her, if you look at the music magazines. So I guess I just was like, turn the page if I had seen it. Like, I wasn't really tuned into that. Mm-hmm. So she has this, she was a person who I didn't really know that well as an artist. And then in 92, which is 2 years later, she went on Saturday Night Live. And on that show, she tore up a photo of Pope John Paul II. And I had vaguely heard at that time, you know, maybe that it was because she was trying to protest the child abuse crisis in the Catholic Church. And, you know, okay, that's cool. You know, that was what I would have thought at Hampshire, like, cool, you know?
Right.
Because, you know, at that point, you know, we were all AIDS activists, HIV AIDS activists, and the Catholic Church, we thought of as being sort of anti-gay and, you know, not very good on the question of what to do about HIV AIDS, and definitely not on the side of being pro-choice. And so, you know, from our point of view, it was just like, oh, she did that. That's cool. Good for her.
And she was actually way ahead of that. It says well before the Boston Globe has that big series.
A decade.
Yeah.
That's 2003. But, you know, yeah, we thought it was cool. I mean, it's not like I was unaware of it, you know, but it did sort of after that, she fell off my radar as she did for many other people. And it wasn't until many years later when, you know, I'm working on a completely different story and I happen on a couple of reaction videos that Fiona Apple has done about Sinead O'Connor, that I start to really think, like, what did happen? How did she rise so quickly and fall so quickly? And so I started to go back and look at a lot of her public statements and a lot of interviews and a lot of profiles and her music. I was shocked to find out she had made so much music after 92. Like, excellent music, not just like, oh, she's putting out some music. I mean, it was really incredible music. And it really got me thinking, wait a minute, like, this is not at all what I thought. And right around that time, she was doing these shows on the West Coast, a small sort of, not, I wouldn't say even a comeback tour. It was sort of just like getting back out there. But COVID happened and that tour, which was meant to be expanded, you know, it had to be paused. And then she entered into a treatment program for, you know, dealing with long-term trauma issues.
Right.
And she also acknowledged substance use stuff at that time, too. But it was announced within that she had planned to put out this memoir and it was still going to happen. And when I saw that, I was like, you know, I've got to get my hands on an advanced review copy of that. Mm-hmm. I've got to figure out a way to tell the story. So I brought it to NPR, to Morning Edition. But I knew even before they said yes that there was a much bigger story than I could possibly really tell. And like, the we only have about 5 minutes on air, maybe if we're lucky, six, seven, you know, eight max to tell a story. So I knew that I wouldn't be able to tell everything. But I think of the work that I do in general as being sort of miniature documentaries, you know, in sound for movies I'd really like to make. Because, you know, it's not just a two-way interview. Usually I'll interview the person, and in her case, you know, again, it's a five-minute story, but it represents a tiny fraction of the amount of time that we spent in interview. You know, it's me then after that process trying to figure out what bits I can pull out to tell the bigger story. So, you know.
Yeah, I've in preparation, I've listened to your excellent productions. Your website is great because you just click on the NPR and you can listen to the what you've done. So I appreciate your work.
Thank you so much. So it was her. I brought in Kathleen Hanna. I brought in the feminist music critic Jessica Hopper.
Which band was Hanna from?
Bikini Kill.
That's what I thought. Okay.
Yeah. And I brought in archival material and, you know, some of Sinead's other music, and, you know, weaved it all together into this 5 minute piece, which, you know, you can still see on NPR's site or mine. But that was really what, you know, we put that up on June 1st, 2021, which is the day her memoir came out. You know, we timed it to coincide with the publication of the memoir. But, you know, I knew even then that there was a much bigger story and I was working on it already. And that was the beginning of the book.
Okay. So I've got so many threads, but what I want to jump to is, so you, what was it like interviewing her? Did you do it like on some format like this?
Yes.
Yes,
this was, you know, it's still during the pandemic and she was in Ireland. So we did this over Zoom. I mean, it was by that point, you know, whenever I do a story, no matter who I'm profiling or who, you know, I try before I interview them to get my hands on as much background as I possibly can. You know, I'm looking at other interviews they've done. I'm looking at other statements they've made. If they've written something, I'm looking at the art they've made. I'm trying to figure out, really not just like, oh, they have a new album. Let's talk about the new album. You know, it's like, I really want to give something to, I think of myself as a proxy for the listener, or if it's in print for the reader, like whatever medium. I want to figure out not just, hey, this is happening, but why it matters.
Right.
And so that's why I do that, because I'm looking for an opportunity to figure out how they've been represented, what haven't they been asked, or they have been asked, but I think there's something more there possibly in the answer. You know, I'm looking for these kinds of opportunities to have that conversation that has, a, you know, some substance to it. And so I had been already so deep in that process by the time that I met her. It was kind of a surreal process to actually be like, click, you know, except they've entered the room, you know, there she is. Oh, wow. Well, first of all, she showed up, okay, because...
Well, that's impressive. She's been going through a lot and, you know...
It kind of is. And, you know, I had already read decades of other people talking about, well, you know, Sinead, you know, you never know. You never know who you're going to get. You never know if you're going to even get her, you know, like... I had talked to the book publicist before I had talked to her and was told, hey, like, there's some questions that, you know, they're going to be sort of, you might want to avoid them. They're a little triggery, maybe not. And of course, you know, whenever that happens, not just with this publicist or this subject, but whenever you get that kind of thing, as a journalist, you're always like, sure. And then no, or then you go in and ask what you want to ask. You know, you try to do it respectfully, but, and we could talk.
Oh, really? Because I actually, if people tell me not to ask something,
we
don't.
We did talk about that, you and I. And I do appreciate that, but you can still ask.
No, I mean,
I don't mean to do it. I think that what you're saying, and I respect you, and I respect that we had that conversation. But I think that oftentimes it's the reason that a publicist specifically will ask.
Publicist is different than the person.
It's because they are worried about something. You know what I mean? Or they want to manage things. And this is sort of a side conversation we could have. But I mean, a lot of times in my field, you know, you want to avoid the sort of canned talking points. You want to avoid the media training stuff. And I think oftentimes when people are doing press, they're doing a lot of interviews all at the same time.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like there's these standard questions and then there's these standard answers.
Right.
And I don't think it's that interesting probably for the person asking or the person answering.
Well, that's my joke. Like, can you imagine you could just do this podcast and it would just be like, hi, why did you write this book?
There's a lot of that. You know, there's a lot of that out there. That's a lot. That's a lot of it. So I think oftentimes, like when I'm talking to somebody and I'm like, hey, and I actually like have done some background research and have actual questions, like they meet you where you are.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So that's, it felt comfortable with her. I mean, you've got to condense this down to this like mini, you know, kind of, as you put it, it's like a mini documentary. How long were you actually speaking with her?
I mean, probably, I haven't looked at the Zoom recently, but you know, definitely more than an hour. And then we had emailed a few times after that.
Okay. So that's very generous. She was willing to speak with you.
She would have kept on speaking, but you know, at a certain point, I stopped that because, you know, I wanted to write a book about her. And if I continued to engage with her, I would be writing a book for her.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, so I'm sorry. So at what point? So there's the interview. Maybe I'm conflating these things. Mm-hmm. There was the interview for the NPR piece, mm-hmm, in conjunction with her autobiography.
Right.
And separately, then you decided to write this book, or had you already decided maybe before that, because you'd done all this research and thought, wait, this is someone who disappeared, but didn't really disappear and has been misunderstood. I want to do a book. Like, what point did that click in for you?
Like, I'm trying to remember exactly like when I sent the proposal in to the publisher. And I honestly don't, I mean, it was kind of around the same time. Like, I can honestly, what I can say is I'm thinking, and I could be wrong about this, I'd have to go back and look at the book. But I think what happened was I discovered the videos, I want to say, in like January 2021.
That's the Fiona Apple, mm-hmm, video where she's kind of also putting Sinead O'Connor on screen and reacting, right?
Well, that was actually, no, this is going to be complicated for the listener. She had put up a video of herself doing a cover song of a non-Sinead O'Connor song called The Hole of the Moon. It was part of the Affair soundtrack. And that's actually what I was watching at that moment. But then, and that was, I think, in around January 2021. Could be wrong. Don't quote that. But off to the side, off to the side of those search results, you know how like when you're on, you search for anything, there's stuff on the side. No matter what you search for on YouTube, it's often Dave Grohl.
Like, I was really angry a couple of weeks ago and I just wanted to watch Smells Like Teen Spirit as loud as I could. Yeah. And then there's something else they suggest to you on the side. And it was like, you know, why don't you watch Foo Fighters video.
It's always Dave Grohl. I don't know, you know, I don't know.
He's an incredible drummer.
But how is it I could be searching for like, you know, treat mosquito bite. It'll be like Dave Grohl, you know. But yeah, there was a couple of, off to the side, there was a couple of videos that were reaction videos. And, you know, Sinead had put up this, you know, this video in 2017 from a travel lodge in New Jersey where she'd been holed up, and it was her expressing her anguish and loneliness. And this is what Fiona was responding to, you know, even though she didn't say it directly. So it just, for me, opened up like a whole, you know, sort of whole set of emotions that as a journalist, you're supposed to just tamp it down. Like, it's not part of the story and you shouldn't even do a story if you're having feelings about it. You know, you should just be like, next. But I knew it was an important story and I wanted to tell it. So in terms of the timing, I would say they were sort of on a parallel track.
Got it.
You know, I got the memoir came out in June, but I had interviewed her way before that, you know, because I got the advanced reading copy. And then, you know, as we set up the interview, and NPR made the decision to time it.
So her memoir comes out in June of 2021,
So roughly like five or 6 months, you know, of me being in this process. And at some point in there, I put the proposal in. But, you know, by the time I'd done that, I think I kind of already knew like, hey, this is the story that I wanted to tell. Now, there is an interesting twist to this, which was my initial approach was going to be just reporterly, like the person you hear on NPR. That when I first started thinking I was going to write this book, I had zero interest, not even inclination, in talking about myself or talking about journalism. That was not at all the plan. I thought it would just be like every other piece I did for NPR, but just like expanded.
Mm-hmm.
But it was in the process of writing the book that evolved. And it was because her honesty made me honest and her bravery made me brave.
Mm-hmm.
And I really felt that it wasn't enough for me to just make a sort of academic or abstract or journalistic argument about why Sinead O'Connor matters. I had to show the reader how I arrived at that. You know, how the whole thing was put together, how I took it apart, and how I was trying to put it back together in a different way. And I also really wanted the reader to be seen. I wanted them to know that I saw them. But in order to do that, I had to show myself. I had to show aspects of myself. I had to think about what are the things that I feel silenced and shamed about that like I've held in, and to let that out the way that Sinead did in her music and in her statements, because that I thought was the way to meet the reader and create this space where we could really have an opportunity to really have a conversation that is really difficult. Like people, the stuff we don't want to talk about is the stuff we need to talk about most.
And I agree, because I think beyond just showing how she matters and some of the parallels in her life and how her music and how what she suffered is so, you know, is familiar to you. I think there's places where you could have just had, you know, that sort of third person, quasi omniscient analysis, but it wouldn't have landed in the same way. And there's this, you know, one thing, and there's so many things that you said, but I love this. You said, I do understand what it feels like to need to hear a voice that sounds like a blanket, a songbook that you can wrap around yourself to hide from your pain. So could that sentence have been worked into the third person? Yeah. Would it have felt the same way it feels? No.
No.
You know? And so there's so much of your writing, like this journey of her life, and then you're coming into her work. I want to pivot a little bit to the, I guess, for lack of a better way to say this, the feminist analysis, and how I found this book enlightening and also so painful, because we still live inside of a really oppressive patriarchal culture that crushes women artists.
Yeah.
And so that's hard. And watching what happened to her, and what was expected of her, like there's so much in this book that I didn't know, about. I mean, I knew some of the stuff that was going on at MTV when she was on the rise, and the, you know, the racism there and the sexism in the music industry, but it was particularly painful to see the way, I guess two things that jump out, to see the way, that, women went after her, to see the way that people allowed bands like the Beastie Boys to be violent and misogynistic, but God forbid she seems a little unhappy when she sings. So that's one thing.
Yeah.
That's coming from the outside at her, that kind of misogyny. And, you know, the Sandra Bernhardt stuff, I did not know that she was so cruel, and that pains me. Men too, but then on the flip side, you know, just recently, and it's in your book, but it's also now all over the internet, the way she attacked other women, you know, hurt people. But, you know, it's been really hard for me when I was reading the message that she was trying to communicate to Miley Cyrus about Wrecking Ball, all with good intentions, but still comes across maybe as an attack. And so I wonder how, you know, this isn't a hagiography.
Right. Thanks for pointing
that out. You're seeing this whole person.
A lot of people A lot of people have said, I mean, some crazy stuff has been said. I think that one of the things I agree with strongly is something that Glennon Doyle said a few days ago, which was, brave women, we know we demonize them when they're alive and we saint them when they're dead. And I agree with that. I think that's the problem, because, you know, and I don't want to saint her now. I think what I want to do is humanize her. You know, I want to recognize her and all her imperfection, as we all are imperfect and we all are human and deserving of that, right? That compassion. So, you know, people have said things like, I mean, and I am also trying to be compassionate about it, but, you know, I've gotten a lot of really beautiful emails from strangers, you know, who feel comforted and supported by what I've said or written, and I feel comforted and supported by what they're saying to me. But there are also people who, you know, like one person wrote me and wanted to know, like, she said, I really want to read your book, but I want to know if Sinead blessed it. Literally, she wanted to know if Sinead blessed it. I don't know how to respond to that kind of question. I think Sinead was a human. She was a brave human. I think the more that we can understand that, like, I think the more that we can really take from her what will propel the culture forward. So many times you see her, she wants to talk about, as you said, sexism, racism, HIV/AIDS awareness before other people are talking about that, mental health before other people are talking yep. about that. And like, these are the conversations that she tried to spark, you know, from day one, really, of her career. And we need to have those conversations. We didn't want to have them, you know, which I think explains right. a lot of the resistance, you know. We knew her head was shaved. We didn't know that what she was doing was saying, I refuse to let the record label and by extension, the broader music industry sell me on my appearance when I want to be, you know, out there for my music. She considered herself right. a protest singer, wanted to be like a Bob Dylan or a John Lennon or a Bob Marley.
Right.
We knew she had that hit in 1990 with Nothing Compares to You. We knew it was written by Prince, but many people to this day say that she was Prince's protege, which she was not. Many people to this...
And that's even the story I had not known until I read this book, that he was violent toward her.
So
later.
She says... Again, you
so
know,
she says,
and,
okay.
And I think that neither he nor she...
After he died, so he couldn't really respond,
he couldn't
right?
respond, and now she's dead, so she can't respond. But to me, I was more interested not in litigating which of them was telling the truth, but I was more interested in understanding why we perceive this one or that one to be telling the truth. And what I concluded was, you know, that these accusations took place in a kind of really complicated context, right? Where on the one hand, you have a tragic, long history of women falsely accusing black men of assault, physical and sexual. In her case, she said that he physically assaulted her, just to be clear, not sexually assaulted her. But nevertheless, there's this history. And then there's also this history of women making claims of assault against men of all races and being told that they're crazy, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know that you have a background in law and, you know, in the sexual assault area, you know, that's like the whole defense, right? It's nuts and sluts, right? She was nuts or she wanted
I mean, it. It's of course not a legal defense.
A strategy. I should clarify strategy, but I'm just saying it's
yeah,
well
there's
known.
No one teaches that class in law school.
I like that, the elective. Yes. The elective, right. No.
Thank you for pointing that out.
That would be
pretty incredible to have yeah. that on the syllabus.
No,
but yes,
but that
no,
comes
of course,
up over
yes.
like she wanted it or she was, you know, she, right. you know whatever, she doesn't know what she's talking right. about, discrediting yes. the person who's bringing the allegation. So I think both of the, that's a very complicated context. And I think if you pit misogyny against racism, like we all lose, right?
Right.
And I think that's really where I wanted to go in trying to think about that claim. But I also, you know, she had said this repeatedly since the 90s, so it's not something she just pulled out of a hat when she wrote her memoir in 2021. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people did say they thought that she was his protege. She was not. And a lot of people were like, that was his big, big hit song. It was not a major hit in his repertoire before she blew it up into this world.
He recorded,
hit.
As you note, after she did.
We had the side project called The Family, but, you know, as a single, it wasn't really, it's not, you know, no. No. It's not, it wasn't,
I mean,
it's not
you know,
Purple
what's
Rain.
What's incredible though is, I'm sorry, even like, and I want to apologize. They're both incredible talents.
Yes, they are.
And the allegation involved maybe like he hit her with a pillow yeah. and she thought something was in
yes.
it. You could imagine that like this was a misunderstanding. There's a lot going on here and
there's so much
I don't
going
want to
on.
Detract. I don't want to detract from either of their brilliance as
no.
an artist. I just thought that
I agree.
Just came to mind.
Yeah.
So before we, wrap things up, I, you know, yeah. I'm just hoping more people read this cause it's so rich. Let's talk about mental health.
Yeah.
Because you know we are now when we're talking it's August 3rd and you know we don't actually know the cause of death.
We don't.
We're making a lot of assumptions.
Yeah.
And it's really up to her family
I agree.
To share that obviously. But we do know that her son died by suicide 6 months ago?
No, a bit longer. Yeah, last year.
And you know, it's what a heavy burden that is for a mother, especially one who wanted more than anything to keep her children safe in the way that she had not been protected.
Yes,
I wonder if you know what we can say about mental health and the importance of taking it seriously, not stigmatizing it, because just as one last little comment before the question, a friend of mine, Veronica, after she learned of Shadaid's passing, put something up on social media, and all she said was, you know, she was a victim of you know, cancel culture and, you know, and stigma around mental health. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that she would have seen herself as a victim of cancel culture. She saw, you know, that moment on SNL is re-railing, not derailing her career, that's right, as you've noted. But the mental health piece, she sought help, but ultimately it sounds like there just wasn't enough. What should people do as they react to that piece of her life and her death?
Well, I think just to go back for a second to the question you asked previously, sure. I think that what I wanted to point out in the book is that misogyny is like, it's systemic, right? So I think we really like this idea that there's the bad guy. Like the bad guy is Pesci, Joe Pesci, who went on SNL the following week and said, I would have grabbed her by the, you know, I would have gave her such a smack. Or Frank Sinatra in 1990, even before that, when she doesn't want to have the national anthem played before a show at the Garden State Arts Center and he threatens to kick her ass. You know, we like the idea of it being like one person, but it really is, it's a cultural thing, right? So I think when you see women attacking each other too, that's part of it. I just wanted to point, that's, I think that's an important thing to bring in.
Yes. No, and why it's considered acceptable. I mean, the way in which when she sang the song War, mm-hmm. and then she took the photo of the Pope that her mother had on the wall, right, which she associated with her mother's child abuse against her, right, and tears it up, yep, and says, you know, fight the real enemy. Yeah. Is that what it was?
Yes.
Or the real evil or something like that. And then apparently Lorne Michael, usually after someone performs, there's an applause sign, turn them off. Mm-hmm. And that was so stigmatizing. It's silent there. Well, the same, you know, they allowed this man to get on stage and threaten her with violence.
Yeah.
You know, these things are systemic. It's accepted.
Right.
We teach these the boundaries in which certain, you know, women can exist in this way. And that was some lesson. Like you, though, at the time, I don't think I had a television. I mean, believe it or not, you know, in the 90s, we didn't have phones that had video or right, computers. We were lucky if we had email.
Right. You just heard about
I'm in
it.
Law
you read
school.
About it.
I'm in law school. Like, I don't even know how we found out about the news. Yep. You know, it was from newspapers, right?
Yeah, probably.
Physical. Yeah. So, you know, I didn't, you know, I knew about this. I must have seen it at some point because it was repeated on somewhere.
Right.
But I think it was probably, you know, it was very... It was immediate, swift, threatening punishment directed not just at Sinead
right,
O'Connor, but at every person who identifies as female or anyone who isn't, you know, going to stay in line. And, you know, you look at the, and I wonder now, now as we really wrap up, what things didn't I ask you about that you think are important in terms of the biggest misinformation and misunderstandings? Can you, I hate to repeat that because it kind of gives credence to it, but I think people have probably heard that. So if you can maybe address some of the top ones and correct them for
us. Well, I think, you know, it was just important to understand, as you just said, that, you know, when people made these, you know, statements and in jokes turned her into a punching bag or a punchline, you know, it landed. Like, people didn't boo them. They applauded. They laughed. You know, I mean, that kind of was part of it. And so I think in thinking about, I'm really, on the one hand, glad to see it, that all these people now all over the world are like, Sinead was right. We love Sinead. Brave warrior. On the other hand, I really wish that she were able to experience some of that love while she were still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the best way that we can honor her legacy moving forward and why Sinead O'Connor matters is because, yeah, you know, she held up a mirror to our society. She exposed this double standard, the gaslighting, the hypocrisy. She exposed all of it. And it's still there. Like, even though she's not with us, it's still there. And so to the question about mental health, yes, instead of, you know, trying to kind of like take her off the stage, you know, cancel her, you know, or continue to bring it up over and over and over again. Why did you tear up this photo? Do you regret it? Do you have anybody do you want to apologize to? I think we should think about how we can be more compassionate, right? And listen as much as we judge. And there's a song she did in 94 called Famine. And the lyrics go, if there ever is going to be healing, there has to be remembering and then grieving so that there can then be forgiving. There has to be knowledge and understanding.
I love what you're saying, and I think the metaphor that comes to mind is she was pointing at various things for us, whether she's pointing at the power of the church to ignore child sex abuse by tearing that up, or she's pointing at famine, or she's pointing at misogyny. And instead of looking where she was looking and following her gaze, everyone wanted to look at her.
Yeah.
She's not asking us to do that. And even now, the idea of, I mean, sainthood, that would be, I think, you know, she is human and we are human and we should be looking at ourselves mm-hmm. and looking at the places that she was directing us to look mm-hmm. instead of judging her. Listen to her words, listen to what her values were and act accordingly, you know, I think is maybe the message here. I think puzzling out what the level of distress she was facing mm-hmm. At this point doesn't make a lot of sense. Instead, look at ourselves and the people around us who are struggling.
That's right.
And see what we can do for them.
That's right. Because I think if we do that, we'll all be in a much better place.
Thank you so much for taking this time to talk about Sinead and your own life.
Well, thank you so much for having this conversation with me. It's really nice to be able to have a real, genuine, honest to God conversation, and I appreciate it so much.
I try. I have always admired Sinead O'Connor and worried about her mental health and the way she was treated by her family and the music industry. In terms of admiring her, I saw her, just as Allison did, as kind of a feminist rock icon. She was someone who did what she wanted to do despite the fallout. There's something Allison said in her book that I think captures this well. After the pushback from when she tore up the photo of the Pope, and after the other earlier incidents, when she did not want to perform if the national anthem was being sung, she said, Allison wrote this, she knew that her willingness to express herself authentically and without the slightest concern for professional self-preservation made her dangerous, but also powerful. Allison is, I think, an incredible reporter. And I really appreciated the aspects of this book that talk about journalism. I was particularly struck by something she wrote in the context of studying journalism. And there was a professor that I guess they all called Sarge, who repeated these kind of bromides, like the most important thing is, you know, getting the story down and so on. And you know, she said this, Allison said this, that tuning your ear is totally different than sharpening your pencil. I think that's really important. As a writer, you can listen to what people say verbatim, but that's not necessarily what they're trying to communicate to you. If you're reporting, you may need to ask again, ask a different question, or follow up kind of sideways with some other sources. Because capturing what the meaning is isn't just writing down the words that people say. More on Allison, you know, in her, you know, she's done quite a bit of reporting for NPR, and she said back in the days, I'm quoting her here, in the days when NPR had public commenting, guys would often post praise for my work. Wow, a chick who knows about rock. And then she added, as I navigated that minefield, I consciously remained behind the curtain. In this way, you know, speaking with Allison, I just want to say I find her to be, you know, the parallels in terms of admiring someone who is trying to operate authentically in what is a male world, in Sinead's case, rock music or punk music, depending on how you look at her work. And in Allison's case, reporting on music. Here's one last thing I want to read from the book about the MTV era when Sinead was first coming up. While it was totally cool for U2, Michael Stipe, and Sting to flaunt their activist bona fides, female artists were supposed to stick to the music, singing sexual come-ons, love songs, or songs about nothing. Baby, baby, baby. Anyway, I really do hope that you take a moment and honor the work that Shanae did to point us in the direction of helping people less fortunate than ourselves, working to fight things like injustice and hunger and racism, and that we all work together to support our own and to support the mental health of others as well. Please consider reading. I strongly recommend it. It's a quick read. It's a passionate and well-informed read, Why Sinead O'Connor Matters by Allison McCabe. And thanks again for listening to another episode of Booked Up. As you know, I will be back next week with another show as we continue to explore the writing process and the nonfiction world together. Let us know what you think. Send an email to bookedup@politicon.com, or you can also write to us, bookedup at P.O. Box 147, Northampton, Massachusetts, 01061. I've been getting lovely postcards from listeners there. It's been a lot of fun. To keep up with the show and our favorite authors, please follow Booked Up on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really will help other people find the podcast. And if there ever is going to be healing, there has to be remembering and then grieving, so that there then can be forgiving. There has to be knowledge and understanding.